Hello and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And a little bit off the beaten track, we'll be speaking in a few minutes with Katha Pollitt, who not talking about her political writing and her essays and columns, but a book of poems she just came out with called The Mind-Body Program. And very, very fine poems, just published by Random House. And if you haven't read Katha Pollitt's poetry, it's... might surprise you. That's rather different from the political writings that many of you are probably familiar with. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll talk with the health economist Len Rodberg, who is with Physicians for a National Health Program, New York City chapter, about what is going on down in D.C. with all these health care reform proposals, what's in those bills, and the coverage in the what the bloggers call the MSM, the mainstream media, has been not so good, not so informative. These are extremely flawed proposals. These are not much of anything, reform proposals. So we will get the details on just how little is less than meets the eye is there when we talk to Len Rodberg at the bottom of the hour. Before all that, some words on the economic headlines. Some more signs of economic recovery, though as usual, take this announcement with plenty of caveats and qualifiers. The National Association of Home Builders, for them, like Bob Dylan, it's not a house, it's a home. Well, if you've ever read Paul Fussell's entertaining book Class, you know this is an achingly middlebrow usage. The National Association of Home Builders issues a monthly housing market index. It's a measure of builder perceptions of present and future sales, as well as interest shown by prospective buyers. June's reading was 17 on the index, up 2 points from May. Rather, July's reading was 17, up 2 points from June, and more than double January's all-time low of 8. All-time, in this case, begins in 1985. This is the first time in 4 years that the year-to-year change in this index is positive. The level of the home builders index is still quite low, but it does seem to be signaling an impending bottom in the housing market. And since housing tends to lead the broader economy on both up and down swings, this is also good news for just about everything else, or could be, caveat, qualification. And speaking of leading economic indicators, the Economic Cycles Research Institute's weekly leading index, which forecasts moves in the U.S. economy 3 to 6 months out, continues to trend higher. It bottomed in March and has been working its way upwards pretty much every week since, 15 out of the last 17 weeks to be precise. This suggests that the broad economy, as measured by GDP, should bottom out in the late summer or early fall. Yet I know it's hard to believe, even for me, but the ECRI leading index does have a very good record. But as I've been saying here, the job market will probably be the last place that's going to see an economic recovery, even after all the other conventional indicators have bottomed out. There are several reasons for this. It's become the pattern in the last few economic cycles, that's one reason, and that may be because of far more intense pressure coming from Wall Street and corporate America to produce high and rising profits than we saw in earlier decades. Another reason is that almost three-quarters of the jobs lost in this recession are gone forever. They are categorized as permanent job losses by the Bureau of Labor Statistics in the jargon, as opposed to temporary layoffs that were characteristic of earlier recessions. Just one-tenth of the rise in unemployment in this downturn is attributable to temporary layoffs in the Savage Recession of the early 1980s. Just half of the job losses were permanent, and a quarter were temporary layoffs, meaning that the job losers were typically recalled to work when the economy improved. Or, another way of looking at it, in this recession, permanent job losses outnumber temporary layoffs by about 7-1. In the early 1980s, it was just 2-1. Still, there is a little good news coming out of the job market. On Thursday morning, we learned that first-time claims for unemployment insurance filed by people who have just lost their jobs fell by 47,000 last week, a big number, and the number of continuing to draw jobless benefits fell by an even bigger 642,000. Some of these declines may be caused by technical factors, like adjusting for the July 4th holiday and the odd seasonality of automobile sector layoffs, but still, both series are now in downtrends, especially the initial claims numbers, and are behaving very much like they did at the end of earlier recessions. So I'd be shocked to see employers go on a hiring binge anytime soon. The hemorrhaging in the job market looks to be ebbing. Caveat, qualification. Hey, but it's happy time around Goldman Sachs. The monster of Wall Street, which increasingly looks a lot like the owner of the U.S. government and just about everything else as well, had a blowout quarter, and is likely to pay its top bankers bonuses close to the boom time max. It's 2007 all over again. Of course, Goldman might not even be here today if it hadn't gotten rescued last year by the U.S. government. But that's all behind us now. I asked Matt Taibbi, who was on this show last week, talking about his article on Goldman and Rolling Stone, for a comment on the bank's huge profits last quarter. His answer, how about, who says government welfare doesn't work? Seriously, it's an outrage. Massive government subsidies turned directly into bonuses. Disgusting. End of the quote from Matt Taibbi. And no recession in China to speak of. We learned on Thursday that the Chinese economy grew by almost 8% in the 3 months ending in June at an annual rate, down from the 10% plus numbers we got used to a couple of years ago, but still quite an impressive number in the midst of this global slump. Deserving major credit, the Chinese government's pumped huge sums into their economy. It also looks like the Chinese economy, though, is moving from being export-driven to a more domestically-centered thing, which would be good news for the Chinese people who've seen some gains from the boom of the last few decades, but nothing like the big numbers you see in the conventional economic stats. Now, if they could only do something about those greenhouse gases. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we will be back. And that was some of In the Mind of the Bourgeois Reader, catchy title. I'm not sure what it has to do with the lyrics. That from Sonic Youth's, I think, 1993 album, Experimental Jet Set Trash and No Star. And we're now joined in the studio by Katha Pollitt, who most famous as a columnist for The Nation magazine, but who is the author of a collection of poems that just came out from Random House called The Mind-Body Problem. It says on the cover, winner of the National Book Critics Circle Award. I imagine that was that for your first book of poems?
Yes, it was. Yeah.
Which was Arctic Traveler from...
Antarctic.
The other one.
Down there.
From 1982?
Long time ago.
Is this your first book of poems since then?
It is, yes.
Wow. Have you been writing all those years?
A little bit at a time, yeah.
And so these poems come from the last 26, 27 years?
Well, mostly not quite that old. Most of them are more recent than that.
Before we talk poetry, I do want to see if you have any thoughts on the Sotomayor thing.
She has a great voice, don't you think?
Yeah.
I love her voice. I could listen to her all day. And I could also listen to her many racist, obnoxious questioners. Every time Jeff Sessions asks the question, I think, listen up, all you Hispanic voters out there.
A man who once had kind words about the Klan, right? I
think. He did. Yeah. But I just think the Republicans, what do they think they're doing? They're sending a great big shout out to all the old white people.
Dwindling band of yahoos that are their base.
It's true. It's quite something.
Yeah, it is really amazing. And, of course, would a man be subject to the same kind of treatment?
Not a man like Sonia Sotomayor, no.
Yeah.
No. And how about all the people who, when she first was nominated, said, oh, but she's too fat. She's too fat to be on the Supreme Court. It's unbelievable. And they're saying the same thing about Regina Benjamin, the new the nominee for Surgeon General. She's too fat.
Well, I just was reading today that Fitness Magazine is the great success story of an industry where there aren't very many success stories. So Americans have a strange relation to fitness and fat.
They like to read about it.
Yes.
and insult each other.
Yeah. Well, we are the fattest people on earth, according to the latest social indicators from the OECD.
I thought it was Mexican.
They're second, I believe.
Okay. Yes. So we win.
We win, yes. And it's interesting. The fattest countries are countries with sort of neoliberal economic models, very high poverty rates, wide variations in the distribution of income, and the slender countries are the social democracies of Northwestern Europe.
So there's the message in there.
There's some sort of message there, I think. All right, well, let's talk about poetry. Writing poetry is a very different skill and a frame of mind from writing political columns, isn't it?
It is. It is. It's very different. For one thing, you don't have a deadline. I think there should be more deadlines in poetry. With my column, I have to write it. You know, the show must go on. I can feel inspired or I can feel truly dull, but I have to write that column. With a poem, it's never like that. And I think I would have been written a lot more poems if I'd had more deadlines. So I'm trying to put deadlines into my life as a poet, but I haven't quite figured out how to do that.
And was this this whole career as a political columnist kind of a unintentional detour when you got into doing it?
Well, I think you can do both things. I think a lot of we have an idea of poets in this country as very airy-fairy is the word that comes to mind, very removed from real life.
Well, the poets often live up to that reputation.
Real Luftmensch and the female equivalent of a Luftmensch. But why shouldn't poets be involved in daily life? Yeats was. Lots of poets were. This is a new idea about poetry. But I just reviewed a biography of Byron for Slate magazine. Byron was very involved in the issues of his day.
Well, and a lot of his poetry is kind of topical.
And a lot of his poems are topical.
Even Shelley, who is
totally
Mr. Romantic Poetry,
mm-hmm. Yep.
was involved in the issues. Wrote a poem about the corn laws, right?
And so was Wordsworth before he changed his mind and became really conservative.
Yeah. But your poems are not, and I got to say, they are very lovely. They're very
Thank
fine
you.
Poems. I'm very,
Thank
very
you.
Impressed, and everyone should go out and buy this book.
It's important to say that.
Yes. And I'm going to say that again at
good,
the end of
good.
The segment. But they're not what one would expect from having read your columns.
Well, you know, they're not. They're in a different tone of voice. My column tends to be pretty argumentative and pretty punchy, and I try to cram a lot of facts in there. But my poems, I used to think, oh, my poems aren't political at all. But actually, that's not, now that I've read my book, I see that isn't true at all. They are, but at a different level. They're about our life as human beings on this planet. They're about men and women. They're about...
But they are, to use a cliche, more personal.
Well, my column is sometimes personal.
Yeah, but...
Personal can be political.
Your tone is
know.
Reflective
yeah.
and wistful.
Yes, it
and
is.
And there's a sense of, like, transience and loss. And it's not, you know, polemically attempting to make a better world. I mean, it's like you're trying to come to terms with the world as it is, and it's not a happy thing.
There is some of that, yes. I do put more of my sad feelings about humanity in my poems, yes.
Yeah. Now, I have to admit that I read your first book when it came out, but that
mm-hmm.
was a long, long time
long
ago.
Long time ago,
so
yeah.
So I can't really remember what that was like. But what has changed in your poetry in the last almost three decades?
Oh, my poems are so much better now. If you're only
That's what the blurbs say, too.
Yeah, if you're only going to buy one book, buy the new one. I think that my poems are less, they're a little more down to earth. The language is a little plainer. They're less self-consciously artful, although they're still artful, I hope. But they're more grounded, I think, in life. They're funnier.
Oh, yeah, there's many wonderful turns of phrase and very many things that make one smile. Not necessarily laugh out loud funny, but happy smile funny.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you say this, because there is this idea that poetry is incomprehensible. I gave my book to a friend, and she wrote back to say that she had liked it, and then she said, "This is the first book of poetry I've ever read." This is incredible to me. This is a woman with a column in a newspaper, a woman who is, you know, very well-read and sophisticated and not afraid of anything in life, but she's afraid of poetry. And I think people just think, I'm not going to get this, and it's going to make me feel really stupid. And I try to write poetry that is at least on one level accessible. I mean, I think there's more to them, I hope, than just that one level.
Well, there's certainly a lot going on. It's not,
but you
it's
can,
not Edgar Guest.
But you know where you are. You know sort of what the subject is. If there's a story, you can follow it. And that's the kind of poetry I like to read.
Well, it was strange for me because I used to read lots of poetry. I almost wrote a dissertation on Wallace Stevens.
Oh, and, I love Wallace Stevens.
And Emerson, Whitman, and Stevens, the power trio of American narcissists. That was going to be my dissertation. And I sort of fell out of the habit of writing poetry, reading poetry, when about the time that your first book of poems came out. That was about when I gave up the field. So this is kind of a strange homecoming for me to read poems, and sit down and read a book of poems.
Uh-huh.
But I don't know what happened. I just sort of...
Well, I think a lot of people fall away from reading not just poetry, but also challenging fiction as they get older. You discover Law and Order. You discover mystery stories. Life takes over. And before you know it, you're just in a different place with regard to books.
Is this just another symptom of brain decay with age?
It could be.
Or
you know,
the distractions of life.
I think it's more the distractions of life, you just are fitting so many things into busyness that it's hard to give yourself over to the thoughts and mind of another person.
Yeah, you know, when I was 27, I had the time and inclination to read Notes Toward a Supreme Fiction, and now that I can probably understand it better, I don't have either.
Yeah, that's a good example.
So a lot of the poems seem to be about a sense of aging and loss. I mean, that seems to be, is that something you're thinking about?
Oh, everybody thinks about that. But, you know, people have said this to me, but I don't feel that way about the book. I mean, I think that's one piece of what is going on. Anybody who isn't, on drugs has to think about these things as we get older. Maybe even before you get older. I've always thought a lot about these things, haven't you?
It was much more abstract in those
days.
When you're in college, you can't even imagine being 30.
Yeah, because then we wouldn't be able to trust ourselves.
Right. I remember, 30 seemed so ancient, and now, of course, 30 seems very youthful, and one gets nostalgic for it.
Mm-hmm.
But I was really surprised to see a section of poems inspired by the Bible. As an old secularist, I was a little surprised to see you.
I'm an old secularist, too.
I meant that about you.
Right. Yes, okay. They're very old and interesting stories. And if you can write poems about the Greek myths, you know, or Gilgamesh, or...
But nobody pretends to believe in those.
No, it's true. They're very strange and odd stories with odd details in them. And what's amazing is that, just like with the Greek myths, you can always find something new in them because they're stories that speak to very elemental things that are very, about which there is a lot to say, but not that many final answers. I could read one if you like.
I was just about to ask you. I'd like you to read, choose what you like.
Okay. How about if I read a story, the first of the Bible poems, which is a story everybody knows, the story of Adam and Eve. This is called The Expulsion.
Oh, yes, I like that very
much.
This
is The Expulsion, and it's about them being expelled from the Garden of Eden. The Expulsion. Adam was happy. Now he had someone to blame for everything. Shipwrecks, Troy, the gray face in the mirror. Eve was happy. Now he would always need her. She walked on boldly, swaying her beautiful hips. The serpent admired his emerald coat. The angel burst into flames. He'd never approved of them, and he was right. Even God was secretly pleased. Let history begin. The dog had no regrets, trotting by Adam's side self-importantly, glad to be rid of the lion, the toad, the basilisk, the white-footed mouse, who were also happy and forgot their names immediately. Only the tree of knowledge stood forlorn, its small, hard, bitter crab apples glinting high up in a twilight of black leaves. How pleasant it had been, how unexpected, to have been, however briefly, the center of attention.
Well, that was one of those moments where I had a little smile because there was some humor in there.
Uh-huh.
But, it was also very moving. And
You feel a little sorry for the tree of knowledge.
Yes, no.
It had its moment. That was its close-up.
Right, now the tree of ignorance has got the center of attention. Well, yeah, why don't you read a couple more? Because
okay.
They're really lovely.
I
like the title one.
The Mind-Body Problem. Yeah. Okay, I'll read that. Okay, this is called Mind-Body Problem. I majored in philosophy, and that title is just about all I took from it. So this is my version of the very famous Mind-Body Problem. When I think of my youth, I feel sorry not for myself, but for my body. It was so direct and simple, so rational in its desires, wanting to be touched the way an otter loves water, the way a giraffe wants to amble the edge of the forest, nuzzling the tender leaves at the tops of the trees. It seems unfair somehow that my body had to suffer because I, by which I mean my mind, was saddled with certain unfortunate high-minded romantic notions that made me tyrannize and patronize it like a cruel medieval baron or an ambitious English professor husband ashamed of his wife, her love of sad movies, her budget casseroles and regional vowels. Perhaps my body would have liked to make some of our dates, to come home at 4 a.m. and answer my scowl with none of your business. Perhaps it would have liked more presents, silks, mascaras. If we had had a more democratic arrangement, we might even have come, despite our different backgrounds, to a grudging respect for each other, like Tony Curtis and Sidney Poitier fleeing handcuffed together, instead of the current curious shift of power, in which I find I am being reluctantly dragged along by my body as though by some swift and powerful dog. How eagerly it plunges ahead, not stopping for anything, as though it knows exactly where we are going.
Yeah, I was thinking about Emerson said the body is part of the not me. So I guess this is an old American tradition.
I think it is an old American tradition.
One more poem I'd like you to read is the Epithalamium.
Oh, okay. I wrote this for the marriage of two friends, and an Epithalamium is a poem that celebrates a wedding. So this is that. As soon as I can find it, let's see, where is it? I have I don't have pages on my...
Oh, yes.
Yeah, okay, so...
Here it is.
So...
My copy.
You know, I've got it. Now, an interesting feature of this poem that not everybody will notice is that it's written in a formal meter, Sapphic, the meter that Sappho wrote many of her poems in. But this was not a Sapphic wedding. This was a heterosexual wedding. Okay, Epithalamion. The boy who scribbled "Smash the State" in icing on his wedding cake has two kids and a co-op, reads, although pretends not to, the living section, and hopes for tenure. Everything's changed since we played capture the red flag between Harvard Yard and the river. Which of us dreamed that history, who grinds men up like meat, would make us her next meal? But here we are in a kind of post-imperial permanent February, with offices and apartments, balked latecomers out of a Stendhal novel, our brave ambitions run out into sand, into restaurants and movies. July at the Cape, where the major source of amusements, watching middle-aged Freudians snub only just younger Marxist historians. And yet, if it's true, as I've read, that the starving body eats itself, it's too true, too, it eats the heart last. We've lost our moment of grandeur, but come on, admit it, aren't we happier? And so let's welcome the child already beginning, who'll laugh, but not cruelly, I hope, at our comfy nostalgias, and praise, friends, praise, this marriage of friends and lovers made in a dark time.
So are we happier?
I'm happier than I was when I was in college, definitely.
Yeah. So I wasn't exactly accurate when I said at the beginning of the poem is much about loss and disappointment and disillusionment.
Right, that's about sort of losing your youthful moment of taking over buildings, with SDS, and finding something else.
The living section.
That was right. But the funny thing is, you can tell that poem dates itself because now nobody pretends not to have read the living section. Everybody's just sort of given up on that.
Well, nobody reads newspapers anymore.
Well,
at least no one under the age of 40 reads the newspaper.
Yes,
anymore.
But this is the poem about people who are a little bit older.
You're going to Germany for a year?
I'm going to Germany, yes. My husband is going to be a fellow at the Wissenschaftskolleg, or Knowledge College,
yes.
The Institute for Advanced Study. So I'm going along for fun.
A trailing spouse.
I'm going to be a trailing spouse. We'll see how long I last.
How about that?
Now, yeah.
You are a bit of a Germanophile, though, right?
Well, I love Wagner.
Uh-huh.
I love Wagner, and I like the German language. I think it's a very, you know, people think of it as very ugly. I don't see it that way.
I think it's beautiful.
I think it has a lot of character, and there's a lot of great writing in German, and great music in German, and I hear the food is quite different than what we think of as German food. Now it's very elegant, and Berlin is supposed to be the most exciting place in the world to be.
Yeah, I envy you. I spent a few days in Munich, and the food is very German there, but I think Berlin is a bit more worldly than
Munich. Uh-huh.
Are you continuing to write poems?
Yes, I am. That's what I'm going to do there, I think, yes.
And where will they be published?
Well, I don't get to decide that.
You'll be submitting them, though.
I mean...
Well, you could always write your nation columns as
well. Well, you know, I did publish... There is one poem in this book, which is very political, called... trying to write a poem against the war, and I did publish that in my column.
Well, what about writing political poetry? I mean, it doesn't necessarily have a good reputation. How did you feel about doing it?
Well, it was a challenge, and the poem, which I could read if we have time, is sort of about the difficulty of doing that. You know, I said in an interview that I didn't like political poetry, but when I think about it, what I really meant was a certain kind of very obvious protest poetry, where the point is, I, the poet, I'm such a great person, I really hate war, you know?
Yeah.
War is so terrible, people get killed, they die, there's blood. That kind of, almost like a leaflet kind of a political poem, I think, you know, if there's nothing, there's no point in writing a poem unless you have something to say that you can't convey in a leaflet or an article or a letter or an email or just by calling somebody on the phone. There has to be another layer of that the language has to be doing something. And that is missing from the...
Yeah, well, that's
you know,
antithetical to the didactic polemical mode. That,
right, didactic is another word that, that applies to the...
When I interviewed Ned Sublette on the show a few years ago, he said the disparaging term they use in Spanish for... bad political music is pamphletismo.
Ah, okay. I'm going to use that word.
So,
that's great.
It was nice to learn it and the word for it.
Pamphletismo.
Pamphletismo.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you. And as I said 20 minutes ago, everyone should go out and buy The Mind-Body Problem, a collection of poems just out from Random House by Katha Pollitt, who has been our guest for the last 20 minutes or so.
Thanks so much for having me, Doug.
Thanks for coming by. Good luck with the book. Have fun with your reading and enjoy Berlin.
Thank you.
All right. This is WBAI in New York, 99.5 in your FM dial, on the web at WBAI.org. And if you visit the website, be sure to hit that donate button, because we'll be doing a fundraiser soon. We can always use your cash. My name is Doug Henwood, a program behind the news. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to hear from Len Rodberg. And that was some of Bach's cantata number 161, Komm, du süße Todesstunde, Come Sweet Hour of Death, which is a macabre way to introduce a segment on how awful the health care reform coming out of Washington is likely to be. But that's what it is. This is an interview with Len Rodberg, who is a professor of urban studies at Queens College and works with the New York chapter of Physicians for a National Health Program. Len Rodberg. Welcome, Len. So where are we in this process of health care reform? A couple of things are making their way through Congress. Just to give us the lay of the land down there.
Well, if we go back a few months, the president kind of laid out his goals, which were to control costs and offer people choice of both health plan and doctor, mostly concerned about controlling costs, which I think is what concerns most people. He then turned it over to the Congress, which is like giving the wolves the decision-making process.
The president himself really didn't lay out a very specific plan, did he?
No, he did not. I mean, during the campaign, he laid out a plan, some aspects of a plan, but he did not lay out a plan this time. He said that it was up to the Congress to develop it, and they did. They made it very clear right away that they were going to use the Massachusetts plan as their model, the plan that Massachusetts set in motion 3 years ago, which is basically a mandate to have either employers provide insurance or individuals buy insurance if their employer doesn't provide it. So it's a combination of an employer mandate and an individual mandate. And the core of it is that it leaves private insurance exactly the way it is now, with no significant change, other than that they have to take you as a customer if you want to buy their product.
Now, there is talk of a public option, although the administration's wavering on that. Tell us what that means and what the state of that is.
Well, there's a proposal that's been around actually for a few years. It began with Jacob Hacker, formerly of Yale, now University of California, which would basically, the original proposal was that in expanding insurance to cover everybody, the government would make available a plan somewhat like Medicare, in that anybody who didn't have insurance could be in this public plan, which would have a lot of attractive features. It would be comprehensive, and it would be kind of the default plan in which if you didn't have insurance, you'd automatically be in this plan. And Obama's been pushing pretty hard for a public, so-called public plan or public option, but it's been radically transformed within the Beltway, which looks on healthcare very differently than those of us look on it outside. Within the Beltway, the issue is what can we do to preserve and protect the private insurance industry?
Yeah, there are a couple of rich quotes from senators to the effect that we can't make the public option too attractive because it would put the insurance companies out of business. I mean, they've been very naked about disclosing that, haven't they?
Absolutely. They've been very direct that if there's to be a public plan, it cannot compete, quote, unfairly with private insurance. And so the more progressive proposal that's come out of the House and the proposal that's come out of the at least one of the committees in the Senate would require this public plan to basically behave just like private insurance. It's got to be on its own, no federal subsidy, no government subsidy of any kind. It has to provide three levels of coverage, or three different levels of copays, or as we would say, three levels of underinsurance. But it's going to be operating in a market. I call it private insurance masquerading as a public plan.
How would it compare to Medicare?
Totally different. Medicare, for instance, when you turn 65, you're automatically on Medicare. Medicare has very specific rules. There are no levels of options. Its copayments are too high, but they're fixed. There's only one level of Medicare. It's not a complicated system. It's very simple and straightforward. There are Medigap plans, which are specified by the federal government, so you know exactly what kind of coverage you get. These plans would be basically freestanding on their own. There's no way of knowing what their costs would be, what their reliability would be, how many people would sign up, because unlike Medicare, which has a fixed known customer base, which is everybody who's over 65 is automatically in Medicare, these plans would depend on attracting customers. In other words, they have to advertise and entice people to come in, just as the private insurers will advertise. It's not clear it'll be viable, because it would depend. It's like starting a whole new insurance company from scratch when United Health and WellPoint are out there with all their resources already in existence. So this fledgling plan wouldn't have much going for it, except its overhead would be a little lower because it wouldn't have to have profits. But it still would have to market itself. It still would have to promote itself and spend money on marketing and probably on the other kinds of reviews, utilization reviews and so on that private insurers do. So it's a very skimpy, limited version of the vision that people had years ago of this really attractive public plan, which would kind of be a way of leading to a single payer plan, which is where we should be heading, in fact.
Yeah, what was the idea of the original public option? It was more of a public subsidy and take advantage of public sector cost advantages?
Right, it would take advantage of public sector, but it would also be a default plan. That is, everybody who didn't have insurance would automatically be in the public plan, so it would start off with a big base of clients or users or customers, and so in attracting doctors and hospitals to take that form of insurance, you'd start off with tens of millions of people as the potential customers. The original idea would be that people, you know, were like in Medicare, would automatically be in it. They could opt out. They could choose to be in a private plan, as people now in Medicare can. But you would start out with this very large base of people in a public plan and public government plan, as people know from Medicare, is reliable. You know you're going to get covered. You're not going to be told that your treatment is not allowed. Your illness isn't covered because of pre-existing conditions. You're not going to be told any of those things. You know that if you're under Medicare, you know you will get taken care of. And the whole idea of the original idea of a public plan would have that reliability and security that you don't have with private insurance.
No, the administration isn't really pushing for anything. Are they letting Congress just work its own magic?
Right, right. Well, they're working behind the scenes with them, but for instance, they never specified what they meant by a public plan. And they left it totally to Congress to design it, and the Congress designed it, as I think you said earlier, with the private insurance industry in mind, and designed it so that it would not be a threat to private industry and to the private insurance industry. They've left all the design questions to the Congress, and the result is that Congress has come up with a plan which doesn't really change, as I said earlier, it doesn't really change anything. It leaves employer-based insurance exactly the way it is. I'll give you one example. Obama has said that under the plan that he wants to see developed, you could choose your own doctor. You could be sure you would always have your doctor. If you lost your job, you could keep your insurance. None of that is in these plans because employer-based insurance remains exactly the way it is. The employer next year can change the insurance, can drop the insurance, the insurance company can change its network so that your doctor is no longer in the network. If you lose your job or move to another employer, you're going to have to change insurance companies and maybe change doctors just as now. In other words, nothing has changed for the 60% of the population that now gets its insurance through employers. The only change is for those who don't have insurance and who, under these plans, would have to buy it.
Would they have any financial assistance for buying it, or are they on their own?
Yeah, there would be subsidies up to 400% of poverty. There would be subsidies. The level of subsidy hasn't been specified. There would be subsidies both to buy the premium and to help cover the copays and the deductibles. If you look at the math, we don't know what the prices would be because there's nothing about price in these bills. The pricing is left totally to the market, presumably to competition among insurance companies. But you can get some idea what the plans will look like and what they'll cost by looking at Massachusetts, which put this kind of plan into motion 3 years ago, and they created something called a connector, which in these plans is called an exchange or a gateway. That is, it's basically an agency that provides you with a menu of insurance plans that you can choose from. And you can go to the website in Massachusetts, I think it's mahealthconnector.org, and you can see the plans that are available. And they're very expensive. They cost for an individual $2,000 to $3,000 a year for the premium, but they have $2,000 deductibles for individuals and $4,000 deductibles for families, which means that even after you've paid the premium, you actually don't get any insurance until you've spent thousands of dollars more. We think of this as underinsurance. That is, it's not really insurance that gives you access to care. It still puts financial barriers in your way. And in Massachusetts, people who used to get free care now are in these plans where they have to pay these kind of deductibles and copayments, and they're staying away. They can't afford care. So many, many people in Massachusetts are worse off than they were before these plans were implemented, and now the proposal is to inflict this on the rest of the country.
They're claiming that just 2% of the people in Massachusetts are without health insurance. Is there something funny about that number?
Well, that's probably true. It's 2 to 3% don't have insurance, but having, as I say, having insurance doesn't mean you're covered. It means that you after you've paid thousands of dollars in deductibles, you then will get some coverage, but you'll still have copayments even then. For every doctor visit, there's a 20% copayment. For hospital stays, there are copayments. So, yes, you have insurance, but whether it's really coverage is really dubious. It's no surprise that in Massachusetts, as in the rest of the country, you know, there are studies that PNHP folks and people at Harvard have done showing that two-thirds of the personal bankruptcies in this country are a result of people's medical bills, and most of those people had insurance when they got sick. They either lost it because they lost their job, or they couldn't afford to keep it, or it just didn't cover their bills. And there's nothing here that says that this will be any improvement. These bills have a limit of out-of-pocket costs. The limit for a family is $10,000. Well, finding $10,000 to pay for medical bills for many, many families in this country is not easy, particularly in these hard times that we're living through.
I'm speaking with the healthcare economist, Len Rodberg, who works with Physicians for a National Health Program. Now, of course, there are two bills now, one in each house. What are the similarities and differences between these two?
They're very, very similar. They both provide that, again, if you're uninsured, you have to buy insurance. You can buy it through this exchange, is what it's called in the House bill, or gateway is what it's called in the Senate bill. If your income is below 133% of poverty, you could be on you can be on Medicaid. If your income is between that and 400% of poverty, you can get a subsidy. Above 400% of poverty, you're on your own, but you have to buy insurance, and insurance can be very expensive. You know, one number that you might want to keep in mind is the average family policy that was bought by employers last year cost $12,500. Well, that's a lot of money if your income is within the range that these bills provide. Interestingly, none of the bills talk about what happens if you're unemployed. Presumably, you have to keep paying your premium if you have private insurance, or you can go on Medicaid if you're unemployed. But, of course, if you're on Medicaid, you're going to see a whole different set of doctors than you would if you're in private insurance. So it's a big gap that I've seen in there that nobody seems to be, especially given unemployment close to 10% today. But they're very, very similar. The public option or the public plan in both is very similar. There's no public subsidy for it. It's set up by government, but it runs exactly like private insurance. It's in a market, has to compete with private insurers, which means that it has to behave just like private insurance. Has to be careful about agreeing to things that are expensive. It has to live within a fixed premium budget. And it's not clear that it will be very much better than private insurance. It won't have to make a profit, so it'll be a little less expensive. The CBO estimates perhaps 10% less expensive than private insurance, but other than that, it will be indistinguishable. So those are that's the plan. They're not, as I say, they're not very different. The core of them is that it leaves the private insurance industry intact, leaves employer-based insurance exactly as it runs now. It simply adds this exchange or gateway where people who don't have insurance will get some assistance. Ironically, it added, even though Obama and others have talked about simplification and trying to save administrative costs, it adds this whole new administrative layer of the exchange. In Massachusetts, it adds another 4% to the cost of insurance to have this agency that's acting as basically as an insurance agent for the private insurers.
You said earlier that it doesn't do much to change the way private insurance is run. Are there any provisions in either of these bills to regulate private insurance pre-existing conditions or things like that?
Yeah, there are some regulations. Basically, the regulations require that they take you as a customer. That is that since you're required to buy insurance, the insurance companies are required to take you, even if you already have a pre-existing condition. There also is a requirement for community rating, that is that they can't charge you more because you have diabetes or some other illness. They can charge you more if you're older, but it's limited. In both bills, it's limited to a 2-to-1 ratio. So if you're older, they might charge you, the premium might be double what it is if you're younger. But there's no regulation and no attempt to regulate their behavior once you are a customer of theirs. That is, there's no regulation of their practices in covering you, in responding to claims, in denying claims, in setting up exclusions and new rules in the fine print. There is no, it's supposed to be simple, but in fact, you're at the mercy of the insurance company once you've signed up.
Well, a lot of people who are insured or think they're insured find out when they get sick that many things are not covered, or the company decides not to pay or finds excuses not to pay. Nothing in these bills addresses those sorts of issues, right?
Nothing has changed about that. They are required to have appeal processes, and they all already have appeal processes. They are usually very complicated and slow, and you can die before your appeal is heard, and I have actually, through my late wife, I have personal experience with the appeal process as being slow and inadequate. When you're sick, you need care. You don't need to worry about bureaucracy and who's going to pay the bill.
The House version of the bill has a provision that would tax people with incomes above $500,000 to pay for the uninsured, which prompted Thursday's New York Post to scream this was oppressing millionaires in New York City. But is there anything in the Senate bill that would provide some kind of revenue stream to cover the uninsured?
The Senate bill doesn't have financing in it because the Senate Finance Committee, which is also developing a bill, is responsible for financing. So the Senate Health, the Health, Education, Labor, and Pension Committee, the Health Committee, their concern is with providing for health care, and so they don't have financing in there. The Senate Finance Committee is clearly not very attracted to the idea of taxing the rich. I mean, the whole idea of taxing the rich is they've certainly benefited well in the Bush years, and they can afford to contribute a little more than they have been under the Bush tax cuts. But the Senate has been talking about taxing health benefits. The government subsidizes employer-based insurance, and they're talking about reducing that subsidy and taxing benefits. Finding a revenue to pay for these subsidies has not been easy. There are no savings that can really be pointed to in any of these plans. They're, in fact, one of the places they're looking for money is in the Medicare and Medicaid program themselves. That is cutbacks in the kind of services, partly in the subsidies that private insurers get under the Medicare program, but also cutting back reimbursement to hospitals. Well, you know, that's not going to expand access to care. It's just going to make it harder for people to get care if you start cutting back on some of the existing public programs.
So the rhetoric of Obama, the candidate, and Obama, the new president, has been fundamental change, major overhaul, ambitious reworking of the health system. What you describe sounds like, at best, a very minor improvement.
It's very minor. I wouldn't call it an improvement, but it is very minor. It's being touted these days as reform and as overhaul, but it's nothing like it. I mean, there are other provisions that are very good, expanding the number of primary care doctors and doing comparative effectiveness research and so on. That's all in there. But this is not an overhaul of the system. It's a very minor tweaking. And it doesn't get at the root problem, which is the private insurance system that we alone among all countries rely on and which leads both to excessive costs and to out-of-control costs. Because there's no way within this system and no way proposed in either of these bills to actually deal with, in any serious way, with the containment of costs going into the future. There are hopes and dreams about prevention or computerization as cutting down costs, but there's nothing serious in any of these proposals to address costs. Certainly the public plan, which Obama has pointed to as a way to somehow be a competition to private insurance and therefore to help hold down costs, will have so few people in it. Let's say under these bills, only about 10% of the population is actually affected by these bills at all, because it's only the uninsured who are affected. And it's so small, it's like a little tweaking of the system. Nothing serious is being done here about the out-of-control costs that we've been facing for years and will continue to face. Healthcare reform is going to stay on the agenda because this is not reform.
And finally, this is something that affects scores of millions of people. It's a massive dead weight on the overall economy. The public does not seem very engaged in or enthusiastic about any kind of major reform. Can you understand that disconnect, as they say in D.C.?
Well, it's very—it's a complicated subject, but there's a real lack of policy debate. I mean, there's a bandwagon effect going on in which people who are, supporters of Obama and have been sort of put a lot of their hopes in him are afraid that if this fails, that it will really damage his presidency. So there's almost no debate about the kinds of issues I've been talking about here. I have not seen any critique of this. The New York Times this morning came out all for it, no criticism at all. No recognition of the really limited nature of this and its real inability, its real failure to address the real issues that face the American healthcare system and that, as you say, provide this real dead weight on the economy. It's going to continue to be a real drag on the economy because nothing is being done in any serious way about healthcare costs or the effects on ordinary people. The number of uninsured is going to keep going up, and the costs are going to keep going up. And until we do something serious about reining in the healthcare system the way every other country has, we can look, you can look at Canada or you can look at any other country. They've all succeeded in making the healthcare system work for people and for the economy, and we have not yet done it. And these plans don't do it either.
I've been speaking with Len Rodberg, who is a policy analyst with Physicians for a National Health Program in the New York City chapter, and a professor of urban studies at Queens College. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this from Santo Gold, along with MIA and Gorilla Zoe. Get it up. Till next week. Bye.
I know.